Hello, I'm Bruce Celery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Financial Literacy Month continues. We have done so many segments about financial literacy for kids, but today's, it's going to be a little different because it's not about kids. It is featuring kids, a kid. Rishi Vamdat is an 11-year-old. He's here to talk about what works for kids and money. He's the creator of Easy Peasy Finance, which is, among other things, a YouTube channel. Then, how to help Canadians build financial resilience. The Financial Consumer Agency of Canada has this new financial literacy strategy, which most of the time using that phrase would bore me to tears, but you will want to tune in for this conversation because the strategy is super clear and compelling, and the guest is super smart and insightful. She is Deputy Commissioner Supriya Sial, and she's here to talk about the strategy. And what are your rights when it comes to credit information? Julie Kuzmic from Equifax is going to be here to take us through the basics, some of which I did not know. Did you know that you can add an explanatory statement to your file? What? Yeah, you can put, my dog ate my credit card payment. I don't think that's going to help you very much, but you could put it on your file. And you bought a home. Congratulations. Good for you. Awesome. Now, how can you use it to grow your wealth? Personal finance journalist and real estate expert Romana King has written a book called House Poor No More, and it looks to help readers with that very, very question. She'll be here. Plus, Piggy and Kitty from Bitches Get Riches. Yeah. Uh-huh. That's the name of their podcast. I can't even. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple, brought to you in part by Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country, and by Home Equity Bank, provider of the CHIP reverse mortgage. Let's get started. The very idea of talking about a national financial literacy strategy on this show makes me want to take a nap, like full on snoozeroo. But hear me out. There are two reasons why I'm actually, for real, seriously looking forward to this conversation. First, this strategy is really good. It is simple. It is clear. It is compelling. It isn't written in the way you think it would be written, like the government, you know, that dialect that we can't really understand sometimes. And second, the guest is really good. Supriya Sial is the Deputy Commissioner of Research, Policy, and Education for the Financial Consumer Agency of Canada. She joins us now from Chelsea, Quebec. Hello there.
Hello, Bruce. Good morning.
I am teasing mostly, but I think a lot of people, when they hear this phrase, national financial literacy strategy, they kind of, if not want to take a nap, they raise their eyebrow a little bit. I believe in it. You clearly believe in it. Why should people pay attention?
Well, what we're saying in the strategy is that financial literacy is a means to an end, the end being good financial outcomes. What we're also saying is that good financial outcomes are a shared responsibility. So yes, we need people to take charge of their finances, make good financial decisions. And you know, who doesn't want to do that? Who doesn't want to make good financial decisions and have meaningful, successful lives where they are not wanting in terms of their finances? So we're saying we need people to do that, but at the same time, it is up to us. So we need to make sure we are creating the environment or the ecosystem around people that will help them make those good financial decisions. So the reason I think people should pay attention is that we are saying, yes, people have got to do stuff, but that the entire onus of that responsibility doesn't just lie on the people. The system around people needs to change to make it better for those people.
I got to tell you, it's pretty motivating to have the experience that there are people on the side of the consumer in the way that you have articulated. And I know that's, you know, probably been the case to a certain extent for decades, but it does feel like we are entering a new phase of cooperation and leadership. Is that accurate?
Absolutely. Yes. I mean, I work for the Financial Consumer Agency of Canada. Our mandate is to protect consumers. We are 100% on the side of the consumer.
Now, you come to this role with a pretty fascinating background, and we've had a number of conversations in other contexts, but I think for this audience, they'd be really curious to know what a behavioral scientist actually does and what you bring to this financial literacy conversation that maybe other people have not.
You know, so behavioral science is essentially at its core a very, very simple proposition. It's saying, let's not make assumptions about people. Let's not say people are going to do X or Y or Z based on, you know, any sort of assumption we make or any thoughts we have about them. And let's stop creating programs, policies, products, anything on the basis of those assumptions. Rather, let's actually study what people are doing. Let's try to understand the ways in which people act or the reasons they act in those ways, and then use that understanding to build things that actually work for the people we are building them for.
What would be an example of that in real life that a consumer, you know, a regular person might see in their everyday life?
Well, so for instance, you know that there's a lot of retirement savings products out there, right? And if you ask the average person, you say, hey, do you think it's important to save for retirement? The average person is going to say, yeah, it's important to save for retirement. In actuality, though, what happens is that there are millions of different decisions that we're making in the course of, you know, our lives. There's so much information we're bombarded with. There's so many things we're trying to do, so much we're trying to keep up with. Life, our kids, our families, social media, our jobs, our friends, that those good intentions don't always translate into good actions. So an example of a behavioral science approach to helping people save for retirement, for instance, is set it and forget it. Mm. So you say once that you want to, I want to save for retirement, retirement product, whoever you are, withdraw X amount of money from my paycheck on the day I get my pay every day. And then I don't have to be bothered about it anymore because you've made that decision so easy for me. I'm not thinking every single month, oh, I got to do that. It's just getting done for me.
Right. It's almost like the water that comes into my house. I don't think about how it gets there. I just turn on the tap and have an expectation that it's there because it was already set, you know, when I bought the place.
Exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, one of the sort of this is like a core tenet of behavioral science, which is that the easiest way to get people to do things that are good for them is to make it easy. And it's based in a very, very, I would say, empathic understanding of human beings, which is that our brains would explode if we had to think as much as we are expected to think about every single decision we have to make in life. There's just too much out there, and we just don't have enough time or enough metabolic capacity in our heads to think of it all. So what the environment around us can do is make it easy for us so that we still benefit from those, you know, those good decisions that we've made, but we don't have to keep making them over and over and over.
If this were television, I would call up your strategy and we would, you know, show it to people. This is radio. So they're going to need to use the Google machine to pull it up themselves. But I think we can just in our conversation bring to life some of the real insights here. Picture a semicircle. There's lots of colors. It says financial resilience. There's a little graphic with roots and money growing out of it. On the left, you talk about skills. And on the right, you talk about capacity. I want to ask about capacity and have you define that for us? Because I think skills, people can kind of wrap their mind around. Like there's some basic skills on, I don't know, managing a budget or ensuring that you pay your bills on time. What do you mean about capacity?
Yeah. So, you know, the way we talk about capacity, we say it is the capacity to build just-in-time financial knowledge and confidence. And really what we're saying there is that yes, financial education is important. Yes, financial education teaches you things about how to, you know, manage your money better, how to live better financial lives. But there's two things about it that are equally important. One, financial information or financial knowledge is most useful when it is relevant, by which I mean I need to learn about the things that matter to me when they matter to me. And a great example of this is, it's best to teach me about a mortgage when I'm in the process of contemplating, you know, when I'm contemplating the purchase of a home, not 10 years before that, not 5 years before that, probably not even 3 years before that. That knowledge about a mortgage, the time at which it is relevant to me, is when I am actually going to be using it. And then the other piece of capacity is confidence. And the reason confidence is in there is that we know that financial confidence, which is, you know, how much you trust your own knowledge, or how much you believe in yourself and your own ability to make good financial decisions. We know that that confidence ends up mattering as much as the knowledge does. In fact, in some cases, experiments have shown, in some cases, confidence predicts financial outcomes better than financial knowledge. So in terms of talking about capacity, what we're saying is, what we don't necessarily need is diffuse financial knowledge. Rather, we need knowledge that is relevant at the time people are making a decision, and we need to give them the confidence that they can make those decisions.
At the next layer, the next sort of circle of the strategy, there's two ideas that I want to bring together. One is communicate in ways people understand, which you're asking the ecosystem, the players, to do. You're also looking at strengthening consumer protection measures. Where's the balance between the regulatory dynamic or the oversight on consumer protection and having an expectation that the players in this industry will behave in a way that has them communicate in ways people understand? And I think about credit card statements, for example. There's a number on there of how many months it's going to take to pay off your bill in full. You know, I most people don't really clock what that means. What would be much more helpful is, here is the absolute dollar amount of the interest you are paying because you didn't pay off that debt in full. And that's not something that credit card companies have a huge vested interest in people knowing, because if they did, they might not leave that outstanding balance out there as long. Where on the spectrum of these two notions, and it's not to say that they're contradictory, but where does the strategy sit and what can we do differently?
So, you know, what you're alluding to, Bruce, are, so communicate in ways people understand is about reducing barriers in the ecosystem. The ecosystem is really just the environment around the financial consumer, right? So it's the system in which the consumer operates. So the financial sector, the regulator, the financial literacy stakeholder groups, but it's not the consumer themselves. Okay. So both of these, communicate in ways people understand, is basically saying lack of understanding is a barrier. We need to reduce the barrier by communicating in ways people understand. On the other hand, the other piece you referred to is what we in the strategy called a catalyst. So we're saying, look, we need to take away barriers from the environment so that people can make good decisions. And we also need to add catalysts to the environment, such as stronger consumer protection measures, also, so people can make good decisions. In many ways, these are fully complementary. Like, they go hand in hand because both of them lead to the same end outcome, which is enabling people to make better financial decisions. Specific example you took, there's lots of research out there speaking to your point about how can we actually communicate with people about debt products, such as a credit card, so that we can help them pay down that debt quicker. There are many sort of examples. So like you said, you could sort of enumerate the actual amount of interest, but there's lots of other ways. I'll tell you an example, which is that people really like this idea. Something that really works for consumers is this idea called mental accounting, which essentially means you divide the amount of money you are spending into different buckets, which are mental accounts. So in your credit card bill, you could have subsets, you could have sub accounts within your bill, and you could have a account for entertainment. You could have an account for, you know, utilities, an account for, and when I say account, they're not actually bank accounts. It's your bill.
They're clustered.
They're just clustered. They're like parts. It's been divided. And we know that communicating information about debt in that way helps people pay down that debt also helps people make better spending decisions about how much should they be spending within each of these categories, or how much debt should they be taking on within each of these quote unquote mental accounts. So that is an example of a way in which we could, you know, as a collective, as an ecosystem, we could say, look, we want to pilot, we want to test in our context, whether using something like that is going to help people understand their own money better, understand in this case, their own debt better, and pay down that debt better.
Interesting stuff. I am so encouraged. I am so encouraged about the road ahead. And I really appreciate your leadership on making a difference for Canadians.
Absolutely. That's why we're here.
That's why we're here. Supriya Sial is the Deputy Commissioner of Research, Policy and Education for the Financial Consumer Agency of Canada.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Lenders know a lot about you. They know your payment history on bills, how close to maxing out your credit cards you are, whether you've applied for new credit cards. But this is your data, and it turns out you actually do have some rights when it comes to that data, some of which I knew and some of which were a complete surprise to me. Here to take us through those rights is Julie Kuzmic. She is Senior Compliance Officer of Consumer Advocacy at Equifax, one of the two major consumer credit bureaus here in Canada. Hello there, Julie.
Hi, Bruce. Great to hear you and be part of the podcast. Thanks for having me.
You outline this in the consumer rights section of your website. And we're going to go through all these specifics. First, credit scores for free. How can a regular Canadian access a credit report or score free of charge? How do they do that?
They can actually go to the Equifax website, which is equifax.ca. And if you scroll down a bit on that main first page that you see, you will see a pretty big icon there that says something like, click here to access your credit file and score. So that's where you start.
Super simple. Now, a lot of consumers would be aware of free credit scores because so many financial services companies are offering them. They offer them for free, but the transaction in that context is then they've got your email address and they're going to send you emails to market you stuff. What are the pros and cons to going directly to Equifax to get that score?
Well, there's the direct from the source aspect, and you can see the information that is on your Equifax credit report at the same time, also for free. So if there is anything that you're wondering about, anything you see that maybe doesn't quite add up, you've got the information right there from the source, as well as the details about how to get in touch with us to correct anything or get any questions answered.
So right, number one, you have a right to be informed and get your score for free. You also have a right to be proactive about security. So this was one of the things I did not know. You can put a free security alert on your credit report. What does that mean?
So how that works is you notify us, the credit bureau, that you would like a security alert on your credit report. And so what that does is it puts a particular alert on that is visible to anyone who pulls your credit report for any reason. So if someone is applying for credit in your name, whether that person is you, ideally, or somebody else doing something fraudulent, that alert will tell the lender that they must contact you in order to confirm this attempted transaction. So when you put that security alert on in the first place, you're also going to give us your cell phone number. And that is what will sit on the credit report so that that lender receiving the application in your name can call you on your phone, make sure that this is you, and you do authorize this transaction, and then that application can continue being processed.
Why isn't that standard operating procedure? Why would someone think to put a security alert on? It's almost like living in an urban city and having locks on your door. You have to, like, it should go without saying, no?
Well, some of this is how the system has evolved, the overall ecosystem over time. particularly in response to changes in how people try to conduct fraud. So this is something that initially was recommended for anyone who was a victim of fraud. And so often banks or other financial entities that were notifying a consumer that some fraud had occurred in their name or potentially there had been some kind of breach, they would be notifying the consumer that we also recommend that you contact the credit bureaus and put a security alert on your credit report. And over time, it became realized that, wait a minute, this shouldn't only be offered to people who are victims of fraud or suspect they're victims of fraud. This should be an option for anybody, whether they are a victim of fraud or not. So there are a couple of kinds of alerts. And this is where the fact that we are regulated provincially can introduce some interesting slight differences between provinces. But the simple view is that there are two kinds of alerts, a security alert or an identity alert, and they're basically the same thing. They both have a phone number attached to them. The consumer must be called if someone is applying for credit in their name, and they're free to put on your credit report.
Right. Number three is the right to be heard. So this, another one I didn't know, you can add an explanatory statement on your file. What could that include? And do lenders actually look at it? Does it inform their decision making?
Well, I don't work for a lender, so I can't speak with a lot of certainty on exactly how this information gets interpreted. But what it actually is, it's a field on everyone's credit report that is called a consumer statement. And it's a free form field where you can put in information like you could add a statement saying, I lost my job in April 2021 due to the pandemic. We'll get up to date on bills as soon as I'm employed again. You could put information like that in there, or I was in a car accident, unable to work for a period of time. Now, that field gets transmitted along with all the other fields when a lender or anyone who has legal access to a credit report, when that report is retrieved, what they do with that information on their side, that is something that is going to be specific to the lender and their policies and procedures.
It would seem like a low probability that that would factor into the AI algorithm that gives a consumer, you know, a rate. A simple credit score is going to be a lot simpler than factoring in those kinds of nuances.
I think it really depends on the lender. I mean, some of them are using, like the big ones, of course, would be using algorithms like that. Others may have more of a manual process when they're evaluating applications, or if somebody falls at a borderline for where, however they are assessing applications, maybe they get kicked out of the process and there's an opportunity for manual review. So again, I think it's really dependent on the particular institution. Mm.
You are also entitled to accuracy. So you review the credit report, you see something that's off. What does the consumer do and what can they expect to happen on your end as the bureau?
So this is something that people are often surprised to hear us say at Equifax, but we want your credit file to be as accurate as possible. That's important to us too. Mm-hmm. We want this information to be correct. So there, it is always free to initiate that discussion, to say, and to execute it. There's no point in this process where you would have to pay to have something corrected on your credit report. That's an entitlement everyone has. The process is called a dispute. And it would even be called a dispute if you're doing something like correcting your address. There is a form that you fill out on our website that there's a secure transmission method. So if you have any supporting documentation you need to send, that can get sent in a safe and protected way electronically. So sometimes people are a little confused to see that the word dispute doesn't fit every situation. So you might say, well, I'm not disputing this. It's just, I want to do an address correction. But you would use that dispute process in order to do that.
A right to privacy is number five. Number six, just briefly here, as consumers, we have a right to have negative credit information removed after a period of time. What is the single most important thing consumers should know about how long things live there?
Generally, it's 6 years. That's the rough rule of thumb. And another thing to be aware of is something like an item in collections. If you have an item in collections on your credit report, it will stay on the file for 6 years from the date it initially went into collections, even if it has been paid. So that can be disappointing and upsetting for people who were hoping that it would be removed from the credit report as soon as it got paid. But I do have a little glimmer of hope here.
Yes.
As that item moves closer and closer to the 6 year mark, as long as there aren't other negative things being reported, so other missed payments or other items in collections, it can have a lower and lower impact on credit score calculations, for example. So it can actually improve over time, even though you still have that negative item on the file.
Right. Interesting. Julie, thank you for your time today.
Such a pleasure, Bruce. Thanks for having me.
Julie Kuzmic is Senior Compliance Officer of Consumer Advocacy at Equifax, and she was here to talk about the rights that we have as consumers when it comes to our data. More info at equifax.ca. Moolala, Money Made Simple, is brought to you in part by Credit Canada. I am the CEO of the organization, and we're Canada's longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency. Our mission is to help people get out of debt so they can get back into life. And we have so much going on for Financial Literacy Month. Go to creditcanada.com/FLM, and you're going to learn about our free virtual events, our webinars, access all sorts of tools. If you are feeling overwhelmed by the debt you are carrying, go to creditcanada.com and book an appointment or find our phone number and call us. One of our accredited counselors is going to talk you down and tell you about the various options that you have. You do have options, I promise you. Moolala is also sponsored by Home Equity Bank, the provider of the CHIP reverse mortgage. Here's the big idea. It empowers Canadian homeowners age 55 plus to live retirement on their terms by providing them with a safe and easy way to access the equity built up in their home. And given the prices of houses these days, that equity can be considerable. The funds can be used for whatever the client wants or whatever the client needs. And that could be travel, it could be helping grandchildren, or it could be supplementing their day-to-day expenses. You can access up to 55% of your home's value with no monthly mortgage payments required. Go to chip.ca to learn how you can stay in the home you love without having to move or downsize. That's Home Equity Bank. Coming up next on Moolala, we talk a lot about teaching your kids about financial literacy, but we're talking with grownups. What about talking with kids or a kid? Rishi Vamdat will be here. He runs Easy Peasy Finance. He's a kid. He is smart. He is driven. He is articulate, but he could not drive a car legally in this country. If you have missed an episode of this program, have no fear. Very easy to catch up. You can head to our website, which is moolala.ca. When you go to the podcast area, you can search by topic, by guest name. You can listen to full episodes. Whatever you want. So go to the website and you can find all of it. Like, we've been on air for years. I don't know how many episodes we've done. It is a lot of episodes.
Hi, it's me, your dad. Look, we need to talk. This isn't working. The missed payments, the collection calls, and all those sleepless nights. We need nonprofit debt counseling, and I found the perfect place. Credit Canada Debt Solutions. They're non-judgmental, 100% confidential. They'll negotiate with creditors and even stop interest. Don't you want to rebuild your credit? You deserve better.
Break up with debt. Visit creditcanada.com.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, SiriusXM 167.
We often talk about teaching kids about money on this show. We talk about financial literacy, blah, blah, blah. But what about talking to kids themselves? What do they think? What do they need? What do they want to hear? Joining me now to talk about his tips for financial literacy for kids is Rishi Vamdat. He is the creator of Easy Peasy Finance. It's a YouTube channel. It's a website. We've talked to Rishi before, and I'm so glad, Rishi, to have you back on the show. Hello.
Hi, I'm very happy to be back here too, Bruce.
Awesome. Why is financial literacy so important for kids?
So there's a few reasons why it's important for kids to understand finance. One is that personal finance is a key life skill, and it's important because kids, and they'll have to learn it sometime, whether they're an adult or whether they're a kid. And if they learn it as an adult, just like anything else, like biking or skating, it'll be a lot easier if they learn it as a kid compared to as an adult. And so why would you make it harder to yourself and learn it as an adult instead of just learning it as a kid when it's easier? And another reason is that kids can take the advantage of the power of compound interest. So kids, if they start investing early and they learn about personal finance and the importance of investing early, then they'll be able to earn exponentially more money than they would have if they learned about finance as an adult. For example, if someone started investing at 20 and invested $100 a month in the stock market until they were 60, then they would have $700,000. But if they didn't learn about this when they were a kid and they started investing when they were 40, with the same contributions, they'd have only around $70,000, which is a huge difference for just not learning finance as a kid. And another benefit of learning finance as a kid is that you'll be able to distinguish between needs and wants and not make a lot of the mistakes you might have otherwise made. So if you know the difference between your needs and your wants, you won't get into a lot of credit card debt, you won't overspend, you'll know to create a budget. And there's a lot of mistakes that can cost a lot of money if you make them that you'll be able to avoid if you learn about them and how to avoid them as a kid.
I just so happen to have an 11-year-old in my house. My kid is precisely your age. And I think anything that I do, no matter what it is kind of wrong, is kind of old man-like, is kind of tone deaf. What would you say to parents about how to talk about financial literacy in a way that kids will listen?
So I think that something that my parents did for me to kind of help me get interested in finance and when I was just starting to be interested, one thing was that they answered all my questions. They took me seriously and they didn't just like, they actually did take the time to answer the questions. If they didn't know, then they would search on Google and find the answer, but they took me seriously. And another thing that my parents did was that they involved me in day-to-day financial activities, whether it was going to a cashier at a store and teaching me about credit cards and how they can use that as payment, or going to an ATM and how they can withdraw money from it. They taught me about all of these different things in day-to-day transactions and day-to-day activities that involve personal finance. And those things also really helped me. And another thing my parents did was once I was interested in finance, they also bought lots of resources. So whether it was magazines or books or other things, they got a lot of those resources for me so I could keep on getting more interested in finance. And obviously, at that time, there was no Easy Peasy Finance, but parents today can also use Easy Peasy Finance to help teach their kids about finance.
How do you think about income? I know you're 11, and that will be probably different when you're, you know, 15 or 21 years old or so. But there's a lot to be done on managing expenses, but there's also a lot to be done throughout one's life on managing income. Have you got a job yet?
No, I don't have a job or anything for earning income, but I feel like it's important, like with a budget, to like once you start earning, to create a budget and to be able to see where your money is coming from and where it goes. And so like once you start earning, and also once I start earning, I will create a budget so that I'll be able to manage my money better. I'll be able to see where it's going. I'll be able to save more effectively and invest more effectively. And so that's what I'll do once I do get a job and I do start earning money.
One of the pros and cons of the generation that you're growing up with is your access to digital, to your phones, to social media, to online shopping, to all those sorts of things. That is an advantage. It's also a big disadvantage because you'll have to use more self-control than I did back in the day, you know, before the automobile and electricity were even invented. How do you manage your own personal balance between needs and wants and managing impulses that you might feel to say, ah, I want that. Just press buy and it'll be here by dinner time if we order it on Amazon.
So that is one of the big things that I feel like is difficult for people. And also it's a big disadvantage to like the time that like right now where there's a constant social media bombardment and advertisement from companies that want you to buy their product. So it's kind of hard to not make impulse purchases, but you kind of like need to have that self-control and not make those purchases because they can end up costing you a lot of money. And for me, I don't really have a lot of wants in material goods. Like things that I buy, products like sneakers or something like that. I don't have a lot of wants in that. So I feel like that isn't much of a problem for me. But I do spend in my family and I do save for things like vacations that we get. But I'm not really that tempted by advertising or impulse purchases because I don't really find the need to keep buying material things.
When I talk to you, Rishi, I really feel like I'm talking to myself many decades ago in that you are smart, you are articulate, you are passionate, and you have an interest in money. I started my own business when I was 13. I was the treasurer on my student council, all these things. But that is not most of your peer group. Most people aren't like you and I. What is it like to be you? And have this passion and have this YouTube channel. What's it like to be you?
So kind of like with my friends and everything, like a lot of my friends, like you said, they aren't as interested in finance as I am or anything, but a lot of them actually do watch my videos on Easy Peasy Finance and they are all very supportive. So even though they aren't interested in finance the same way I am, that isn't really a problem or anything because they are very supportive of me and that's really great.
Don't they wish you could have a YouTube channel on like Minecraft or Leap Day or TikTok? I mean, YouTube is kind of like a bit like your parents' social media platform. You should be a TikToker, no?
Well, actually, we do post shorts, so like a short version of our videos, like the first question, and also other things on TikTok and Instagram and all those other places. So we do have a presence there, but like you said, the main thing is on YouTube. And a lot of my friends, I mean, they don't really talk about this. A lot of them do have TikTok and all these other social media sites, and they do post things on them, but they aren't really like talking to me about posting on those things for Easy Peasy Finance. I feel like they also do use YouTube. It's not like they only use TikTok or other things. So I feel like that isn't something that my friends say.
Well, Rishi, we're going to have to keep in touch over the course of the next decade or so as you both grow and expand your media empire and your financial knowledge, and also are exposed to more temptation of, geez, I got to have this or that or whatever it is. I'm going to be fascinated to see your story unfold. Thank you for being here.
I was very happy to be here as well. It's nice to be back with you, Bruce.
Awesome. Rishi Vamdat is the creator of Easy Peasy Finance. He was in New Jersey today and he's 11, which makes me feel like a super big loser and that I've accomplished nothing because look at him at 11 years old. Coming up later on the show, we're going to talk to two characters, and they really are characters, Kitty and Piggy from a podcast called Bitches Get Riches. I'm almost speechless. You have to listen to this podcast. But first, personal finance journalist and real estate expert Romana King is going to be here to talk about her new book. It is called House Poor No More. If you want some more info on Moolala, sign up for our newsletter. Super simple. Once a month, we'll bring you the stories that we're covering on CBC and Cityline and BNN and wherever else. It's once a month. We never do anything with your email address.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Buying a home is such an enormous step. Whether it is your first or your fifth, it is a big step, especially now with house prices at all-time highs. it's kind of hard to come to that decision, feel good about that decision. It's one thing to know how to buy or sell a home, but it's also so important to understand how to manage your money once you become a homeowner. Ramona King is a personal finance journalist and real estate expert. She has written a book to help on that very question. It is called House Poor No More, 9 Steps That Grow the Value of Your Home and Net Worth. She's in North Vancouver today. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce.
Disclosure. I wrote the foreword. I know of this book. I believe in this book. I believe in the message you have to deliver. And I believe in your wisdom and credibility as a journalist. So first of all, your title declares that it is possible. It asserts that it is possible to be house poor no more. How can that be possible given the average price of anything anywhere in this country?
Oh, I know. And this is the big thing. And it's not this year or last year. We've been listening to this message for the last 10 years. Yeah. And I think that the reason why I say it is possible, you know, I had someone once say to me, you can have anything, you can't have everything. Mm. And so that comes down to buying a home. If you want to buy a home, and you know, we know that numbers tell us that many, many people do, then you can have that. You can take that option, make that happen. But that means you're going to have, you know, maybe you're not those vacations every year. You're going to have to make trade-offs. So it is possible to do it. And it just means we need to be aware of that decision and just how to make that decision better for us, right?
Your answer to the affordability question was really depressing, accurate, but depressing. A mortgage of about 310 grand for a 2-income household. Let's say you have a 20% deposit. So you've got about 400 grand to spend. That will not buy you much anywhere near a big city. Does your book come with Prozac taped to the book jacket? Like, is the dose included?
No, they have to listen to you, Bruce, because you're very positive and you can find a silver lining. What it does tell you, and what I do tell people, is people are buying in those. I mean, I bought in a high price city. You've bought in a high price city. People are buying in a high price city, even their first home. And yes, we have to do it a bit different. And yes, there have to be other considerations. And so you're starting to look at homes with mortgage helpers, or people are buying, renting in the city and buying in another city. And they rent out that, you know, the house that they own, they rent that out to someone else in order, you know, there's lots of different ways to do it. And that's what I actually talk about is when you hear this idea that it's impossible to buy a home, I think it's this zero sum decision, like it's either smart or it's stupid. And I don't like that kind of decision. I think it sort of diminishes the desire and diminishes our decision to actually just become homeowners. So I kind of couch it in a way of like, listen, it is expensive. There are things you can do. You have to be realistic about, you know, the realities of it. But, you know, how are you going to supplement this? How are you going to make it happen?
The first lesson you learned about real estate, which you write about, was the fear of losing out is the worst reason to make a decision. That's really relevant today.
Yes.
In 3 sentences, how did you learn that lesson for what unfolded with your parents?
Well, my parents were educational immigrants, essentially people from England. They had nothing but an education and they wanted a better life for their kids. So they decided to come to Canada and they had nothing but, you know, to build a life. And so they literally scraped up enough. I believe at the time it was about $1,000 and they put that as a deposit. Yeah, I know. So such a small amount, right? They put a deposit on a house. And my father ended up actually losing that deposit. And then he ended up actually buying another house with a mortgage helper. He ended up losing that house because he didn't get the right information. And the fire chief was called and they said, you know, this is not a legal duplex. You can't have. So I saw very quickly, and unfortunately, you know, hard won lessons on my parents' part. I saw very quickly this fear of not, you know, keeping, and that wasn't even keeping up with the Joneses. It was, we want to give a better life to our kids. We're going to miss out and not be able to get in. And so the third house they bought was sort of their final house. That house had a lot more forethought. And my father did many, many different things. And one of the things he taught me was run the numbers, look at your budget, run the numbers again, really be realistic, and then make that decision knowing, eyes wide open, what you're getting yourself into.
One of the other areas where people really need to run the numbers is home renovations. Because so often we get lulled into or entranced by the Corian countertops or whatever it is. And in your book, you talk about how to think through these renovations, and you have particular insight here because you're partnered with a contractor.
Yes.
So it's not only you as journalist, but you as spouse to contractor. What's the number one thing to keep in mind as you think about those renovations?
I would say the number one thing, and most people are asking, you know, is it a kitchen, a bathroom? I think the number one thing is we really need to stop this decision-based evidence building. So I made a decision that I don't like my kitchen and I want to renovate it. So then I go out and I find the evidence to support that. And I'm like, stop.
That's the way I live life. Come on.
Right? Most of us actually do. It's almost intuitive because it's a very fast way of making decisions. But when it comes to renovations, and you know, we know the horror stories of having contractors bail on us, or, you know, the contract doesn't bail on us, but things, you know, get out of hand and the price escalates. So in order to avoid those shocks, what do we need to do? We need to do our research, which means stop, take your time, look at it. And one of the big things that I say is you can renovate for purely personal pleasure. So it's not because you want to add value and you have to find the evidence to prove it. You just have to look at your numbers and say, listen, I'm going to stay in this home for the next 10, 15 years, and I'm going to justify the next 10 or 15 years for loving this kitchen in that time. And it probably will end up giving me some money back, so higher value in my house, but I'm not doing it for that reason. I'm doing it because I know I can afford it. It fits my financial budget. So I would say that's the number one thing people have to look at. I think the number two for renovations is, anytime you're going to do a renovation, whether it's for personal pleasure or not, a smart renovation, a renovation that's going to add the most value to your home, is a renovation that solves a problem. Mm. You know, and every single time we've looked at a house, whether it's a client's house or our own house, if the renovation solves a problem, almost every single time we've had a higher value on that home because the home fits. It makes sense to people. People walk in and say, everything is done. Everything's done. I don't need to do anything. They thought about this. They did this. Oh, this works. And when you have those problem-solving renovations, of course your home is going to attract more value.
We looked at a house once when we were buying in Calgary, and it had a toilet in the middle of the master bedroom. No walls. Yeah. And it was a carpeted master bedroom. Yeah. I can't even, it's one of those things you can never unsee.
Right? Like, how do you even describe, like, I had to go to the toilet, honey.
How is that like, you know, acceptable in any marriage? No. You talk about, and what I think is so great about the work that you've done here is the holistic view of where a house fits, not just within a financial plan, but within your well-being writ large. It seems that people take that, though, to mean buying a house is key. End of discussion, law of gravity, thou shalt buy. When does it make sense to rent?
I think it makes sense to rent when you know that you can actually save the money that you would pay on housing expenses if you bought, and use that to build up your nest egg. So by and large, if you look at housing versus stock markets, if you're looking at just pure returns, so just from purely investment point of view, the stock market is always going to win, has for decades. The problem we have, though, is that very expensive cities, you know, I was just talking to a girlfriend about this, the rent isn't cheap. So you don't save any money by renting. And that's why you have people pushing to try and get into the property market, even in expensive areas, because you can't save that much. But I do think there is an argument that if you're not 100% settled in the community or in the house or in the family that you're in, if you think that you want more flexibility, or if you really know yourself well and know that you can save in a disciplined fashion, so you can take this money you save and put it into investments, I think renting makes a lot of sense.
Well, what makes a lot of sense is your book. And I congratulate you on its launch. And I thank you for joining us to talk about it today.
Thank you so much, Bruce.
Ramona King is the author of House Poor No More, 9 Steps That Grow the Value of Your Home and Net Worth. And there's so much in here. Something called the Smith Maneuver. We didn't have time to talk about it, but there are so, so many ideas in this book. Check it out. Stay with us. Coming up next, highlighting a personal finance podcast called Bitches Get Riches. That's what it's called. It's genius. The creators are Kitty and Piggy, and they are hilarious. So hilarious. Also hilarious is Tracy Moore. She is the host of Cityline, It is a daily lifestyle show on air across North America. I'm the money guy on that show. Check out cityline.tv for segments that we have done.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Finance, feminism, no F's given. That is the essence of Bitches Get Riches, which, by the way, I could say 14 times a day and I would not stop smiling every single time I said it, because I think that is the most brilliant name of a podcast ever in the history of the world. Piggy and Kitty are the founders of Bitches Get Riches. They describe it, their words, as a survival resource for life in a patriarchal capitalist hellscape. Piggy joins us from Colorado. Kitty is in Massachusetts. Hello to you both.
Hi,
Thanks
Bruce.
Thanks for having us.
Oh my gosh. It's hilarious. I don't want your egos to go all the way to enormousness, but it is hilarious. Too late. Already done. What does Dungeons and Dragons have to do with personal finance?
What doesn't it have to do with personal finance?
Oh my God. So who's the D&D, like the primary? One of you must be more into it than the other.
I'd say that's Kitty. Kitty's definitely a little more into it, but we both play.
Kitty, you answer that question.
Yeah, I'm the OG nerd, I think. Although I think Piggy has really sometimes the student surpasses the master, and I think we might be getting to that point.
We are. I made a Pokemon reference the other day, like unprompted.
I was so proud.
I have truly grown.
You could have done a D&D podcast. You could have done one on Pokemon or pop culture. How did you come to money? How did this come to be that you decided to focus on money?
When we graduated from college in 2009 into a little recession, maybe you heard of it, the Great Recession, we realized that we had learned nothing about personal finance and how to manage our adultish lives. So we had this sort of text chain back and forth between each other. By the way, we were college roommates. That's how we met. And we realized that we were kind of figuring it out as we went along, and we would text back and forth to each other. Okay, I just figured out this is what you need to pay off your student loans ahead of time. And this is how you improve your credit score. And this is how you save a down payment for a house. And we realized eventually that this text chain was gold and we needed to share it with people.
our thumbs were getting really tired, especially when we started to acquire the reputation amongst our group of friends that hey, these two, I know they seem like total idiots, but they actually sort of know what they're doing. And then it just they were ready to fall off at that second joint. We needed to utilize all of our fingers to be typing.
Oh my God. Joint in the thumb, not joint as in legal cannabis, which Canada has. Oh, and in Colorado too. So hooray for that.
Oh yeah. And Massachusetts.
Really? Oh my gosh.
We're all
Colorado,
high,
Massachusetts. You're basically Canadians. If you live in Massachusetts and Colorado, it's basically, those are provinces that we will annex soon.
Love it.
Kitty, what is the essence of your friendship? If you were to boil it down into a phrase, what is the essence of your friendship?
Oh my God, what an amazing question. Okay, so I think the essence of our friendship is the fact that she and I really are like sisters to each other. Mm-hmm. And I think having a relationship with someone who is truly like a sibling, where you can piss each other off, you can step all over each other, and none of it ever matters because the love is so deep. What I say a lot is that even though she and I are quite different, we have an incredible ability to mind meld around a couple of topics, and money has always been one of them. And really, I think what it comes down to is the way I've described it in the past. A lot of people ask us, which one of you is the bebop and which one of you is the rock steady? And the answer is, we are both Krangs.
It's true.
I have no idea what any of that meant, but I love every single word that you just said. I also love
Every
it's a golden oldie from Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, the animated series from the 1990s. Look it up. Educate yourself.
I totally, because your lived experience is different than mine. I get it. You two swear, and I don't even know what the metaphor is. I'd say drunken sailors, but I don't know if that's apropos of the zeitgeist. You two swear like I cannot even believe.
Like Midwestern wine moms, probably.
Midwestern wine moms, of course. Is it therapeutic? Is that how you talk in the world? Why is it such a key ingredient of how you talk in these recordings?
No, we dial it back for the podcast.
We do. We try to filter ourselves a little bit. No, but that's a great question. I mean, like, obviously our name of our podcast, of our whole brand has an expletive in it. And honestly, that's because that's kind of how we feel about, again, the patriarchal capitalist hellscape. Like if you're going to be talking about money management and economics in the year of our Lord 2021, you need to be swearing about it because it is messed up.
Kitty, you were an ENTJ, which is the best Myers-Briggs profile of the bunch. And all ENTJs know that this is the best profile of the bunch.
Correct.
How does this inform your view of money in addition to the fact that it just makes it better and easier for you? I know someone else with this profile. He may well be the person speaking right now.
Oh, I recognize the narcissism of my own kind whenever I hear it. You don't have to explain.
Okay, all right.
So this is a fascinating little statistic that I only found out about very recently. So if you look at all Myers-Briggs personality types by their income, ENTJs overall make the most amount of money. Now, here's what's really fascinating. Female ENTJs actually statistically make more money even than male ENTJs. We are the smallest portion of the population by gender. And I think that is so fascinating. Like, there is something about the ability to my favorite breakdown of Myers-Briggs is you got five circles that form this complex Venn diagram, right? And they are dreams, schemes, teams, memes, and regimes. And ENTJs are right at that intersection of teams, schemes, and regimes.
So good. Piggy, what is the most annoying characteristic of Kitty?
Oh,
I know. Where do you get started? I love the sound effect of your hands rubbing together because ENTJs
are
completely unacceptable and intolerable. What
Let
specifically?
Me just
Go.
Pour my tea. Honestly, this girl has a habit of being right in the most obnoxious way. And it infuriates me. And sometimes, like, it's most infuriating when she'll say something and she'll be right about it. And I'll be like, I don't want to admit that because it's hard and it's challenging me and you're getting under my skin. And I come back like 12 hours later and I'm like, all right, so I've concluded that this is the case, but I'm not going to say you were right because that pains my soul too much. So there it is.
It's analogous to a humble brag.
You don't have
I don't even know what it is, but it's analogous. Okay, you have so many great topics here. One of them is, are you a frugal mooch? Mooching off friends is not a valid saving strategy. Piggy, why not?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked, Bruce, because friendship is a two-way street and you should never take advantage of your friends financially. That is one of the leading causes of divorce, of breakups. And I think if we look at friendships as romantic relationships or like having that level of trust in them, then taking advantage of your friends financially is the same as, you know, betraying your spouse's trust financially in a marriage. So, you know, it's fine to be frugal. It's fine to, you know, ask your friends for help or for favors, but that's got to go both ways. You can't just constantly moosh off them and expect that the friendship is going to survive that violation.
Kitty, you also talk about how to avoid lifestyle inflation and when to embrace it. For you as a human on this planet, when do you embrace it?
Parmesan cheese.
Good answer.
Do you buy the good Parmesan?
I'm not on this planet for very long. I need to have that stuff that when you slice into it, it almost like kind of crumbles apart. And then you get those crunchy crystals, the flavor crystals in there. I'm not here for long enough to keep settling for the stuff that's in the shake can. Like, no shade on shake can parmesan cheese.
Oh, that's that's embarrassing.
You know, like that is easy answer. That is my easy answer. Parmesan cheese.
I'll see your quality and raise you quantity, because you need to like double grate that parmesan. You take the and you need to put on twice as much as you think one could humanly possibly consume. Am I right?
100,000% right.
Yeah,
but it's hashtag worth it.
Totally. Okay,
we're here for a good time, not a long time.
100. Now, what do you like? Have you read the mortality tables? You're women. You're here forever. It's the guys you have to worry about. Jeez.
Well, I think it's all for the best, because that just means that my partner, who is the one who habitually undergrates and underestimates the amount of Parmesan he should bring to the dinner table, I look forward to, you know, having those, like, what is it, 7 extra years at the end where I can just grate and grate
it's
to
a
my
frugal
heart's
mooch.
Content.
I hope you pack Parmesan in your purse at all times, and you just pull out that grater and the Parmesan cheese and you're ready to go.
The purse is too warm, so I keep it in my breast pocket close to my cold dead heart.
Oh my gosh, that is so amazing, matched only by Piggy's cold shoulder. And that is how you keep body temperature working for you even in the summer months. I could literally listen to and talk to you both all day. I will give you one tip. You need to go listen to the podcast, Joan, Dear Joan and Jerrica. You will thank me forever. Kitty, Piggy, the co-founders of Bitches Get Riches. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having us.
It was our pleasure.
We're always ready to talk about our favorite things, money, Parmesan cheese, Dungeons and Dragons,
and ourselves. And our Myers-Briggs profiles. That's it for our show for today. Thank you to our sponsors, Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country, and Home Equity Bank, provider of the CHIP reverse mortgage. There is one simple thing you need to do to keep up to date on all things Moolala. It's super simple. It will take you 14 seconds. Go to moolala.ca and subscribe to our newsletter. Once you have subscribed, you're going to get an email once a month. That is it. It's going to have stuff that we're doing on CBC and CityLine and on this show. And that's all you have to do. You can, this is a bonus assignment. If you want to send us thoughts, ideas, questions, comments, whatever it is, our email address, ask@moolala.ca, ask@moolala.ca. On social, I'm at Bruce Celery on Twitter, Bruce Celery Moolala on Facebook. Thank you so much for joining us, and have a great day.